From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we enter the world of high finance and corporate takeovers. I speak with journalist Connie Bruck about junk bond investor Michael Milken, who helped finance the wave of hostile takeovers that rocked Wall Street and restructured corporate America. Also today, I speak with a modern master of an ancient art, cartographer Stuart Allen. His maps are based on the latest computer technology and a respect for the traditions of his craft. Ken Tucker has found a video cassette series that solves the problem of watching subtitled foreign films at home. And fiddler Michael Doucette is back with two members of his Cajun dance band Beau Soleil in our weekly performance spot. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Junk bonds. Well, they weren't junk to Michael Milken. He made a fortune on them. And he used junk bonds to finance major corporate takeovers. In fact, he's one of the people most responsible for fueling the takeover mania of the 80s. Junk bonds are cheap and risky because they're offered by companies that are seen as financially unstable. But Milken calculated that with good research, he could invest in bonds whose rewards would far outweigh the risks. And he was right. While most people on Wall Street thought of junk bonds as junk, Milken's investments were transforming the company he worked for into one of Wall Street's most powerful investment banking companies. That company, now called Drexel Burnham Lambert, is currently under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The investigation is related to the insider trading scandal. My guest, journalist Connie Bruck, has written a new book about Milken and the corporate raiders he financed. It's titled The Predator's Ball. Bruck is a senior reporter for the American Lawyer magazine. She's also been published in The Atlantic magazine, Manhattan Inc., and The Washington Post. She began researching her book well before the insider trading scandal broke on Wall Street. She was able to interview many of the key players before the SEC investigations got their defenses up.
I started it in 1985 when Drexel was a phenomenal success story and there was no hint of the government investigation that was to come.
So you think if the Ivan Boesky bust had happened, if the Wall Street collapse had already happened, if the investigations into Drexel Burnham had started happening, that the people who you got to interview wouldn't have spoken to you?
I think that they either wouldn't have spoken to me or would have spoken to me in a really guarded way. I did have access to some people at Drexel, or actually quite many people at Drexel, even after Ivan Boesky's plea agreement and the start of the government investigation of Drexel. But that was only because I had already been at the firm for about a year, and so I was, you know, as they realized, most of the way through my project. But even so, and even though I knew these people by this time very well, they became much more guarded with me than they had been before that.
You explain in your book that you started very sympathetic to Michael Milken, who you write about, to the Drexel firm, and that you saw them as the kind of underdog in the world of high finance?
I definitely did. I mean, it was sort of an underdog firm with underdog clients. I call them in the book, and I think of them, their clients particularly, as the have-nots of the corporate world, and they were challenging the establishment, and just personally, I always find that attractive.
Now, your mind changed, we'll find out how, a little bit later in the interview. Let's talk about what a junk bond is so that we'll understand the basics here. Give us a really simple explanation of what a junk bond is.
Well, a junk bond is a bond which is perceived by the financial marketplace as being high risk, and because it is perceived as high risk, it pays a high interest rate to compensate the investor for the risk that they're supposed to be taking.
Okay, now your book is in part about Michael Milken, who's considered the king of the junk bonds. If this is considered such a high risk, why did he think that there was more to junk bonds than people had given credit for?
Well, Milken, one of Milken's favorite themes, which he talks about when he gives speeches, which he does infrequently, but he does sometimes do, is perception versus reality. Milken has believed for many years that he sees what others do not, and that the financial world, that there are basically misperceptions about risk, and that many companies which are small or which have don't have credit histories and are therefore rated non-investment grade by the rating agencies, he believes that they are not risky and that that therefore investing in their bonds, which pay a high interest rate, is a good investment.
Yeah, and he thought that if he did the research and had faith that this firm would make it, that he had a pretty sure bet, whereas if he played the stock market, it was so dependent on what other people thought,
well, exactly.
that he couldn't be sure at all. So he felt pretty secure with these junk bonds by comparison.
That's exactly right. And Milken has just immense confidence. First of all, he works harder than anyone I've ever met. So his research was incredibly thorough, and he has immense confidence in his own rightness.
I love the name junk bond. It might as well be called garbage bond. How did it get a nickname like that?
I don't know how it really did. Meshulam Rickless, who is one of Milken's great admirers and clients, claims that Milken coined the phrase himself in a conversation with Rickless back in 1970 or so, where Milken was talking to Rickless about the bonds of Rickless's conglomerate, Rapid American, and Milken reportedly said, "Rick, these bonds are junk," and Rickless responded whatever and said, "Well, yes, but they pay a good interest rate, they pay," and so forth. So Rickless claims that that was the beginning and that Milken's been trying to get rid of that term ever since. I don't know whether that was really the origin or not.
What do you think he'd prefer to call it?
Drexel has for years really struggled to have people call them high-yield bonds. It's only actually in the last year or so, since Drexel has many other worries, that they have sort of relented and referred to them themselves as junk bonds.
Journalist Connie Bruck is my guest, author of the new book, The Predator's Ball, The Junk Bond Raiders, and The Man Who Staked Them. Okay, so we have Michael Milken deciding these junk bonds aren't a bad thing at all. You can make a lot of money with them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so first he starts making money investing in these junk bonds himself.
Right.
Then he figures he can make even more money by getting a lot of clients who will invest in the junk bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And now how would he make money if he gets other people to invest in them?
Well, if he gets other people to invest, basically he was creating a market. In the beginning, when he was buying them, he would buy them for himself, for some wealthy clients. They'd buy them, since they were deep discount bonds, they'd buy them at something like 10 or 20 cents on the dollar. And if Milken was right in his research, then the price of the bonds would go up. So that maybe they'd go up to the full dollar. They always made money. But what he wanted to do was to create a whole market where there were issuers that were issuing the junk bonds and a whole ranks of investors to buy them, and then there would just be more money to be made for everyone. And that's, by the late 70s, what he succeeded in doing.
Now, one of his tools for getting more people to buy into the junk bonds was a big annual party that he'd throw that was nicknamed the Predator's Ball. What was the real name?
The real name was Drexel's Annual High Yield Bond Conference. It was actually called that real name for years. It started back in the late 70s. It was not until 85 that it achieved its nickname of the Predator's Ball, because it wasn't until 85 that the most honored guests there were predators, or predators meaning really corporate raiders.
Okay. At the Predator's Ball, which is to attract new investors into the junk bonds and then to use that money in takeover bids. At these Predator's Balls, there were a lot of lures to attract new clients. Give us a sense of what the big attractions were to get people to come.
Well, basically, there were many attractions. I mean, one thing was that there was a terrific sense about Milken. It was sort of an evangelical event. By the mid-80s, certainly, by 84, 85, Milken was convinced that he was out to change the corporate world, which indeed he was doing. And so many people came because they were just excited to feel part of this whole thing. It was almost like an evangelical meeting. And then beyond that, there were, for the 100 or so high rollers, there were each year the special events. There were dinners at Chasen's, which is this very sort of posh restaurant in Beverly Hills. There were parties later at Bungalow 8. There were really attractive young women whom I was told were paid by Drexel to come. And one Drexel client said they were paid according to how pretty they were and what they would do.
Just some big name entertainment.
There were
too.
Big name entertainment, right? There was Diana Ross, Frank Sinatra. So there were lots of reasons to come, and also a lot of business got done at these. I mean, there were just deals being made right and left for loads of people there.
How? What's the connection between the junk bonds and the corporate takeovers, the takeover mania of the 1980s? How are the junk bonds used to finance corporate takeovers?
Well, the junk bonds are basically, the junk bonds are what have made it possible for the takeovers to be as enormous as they have become. Only junk bonds, basically, in any one of these takeovers, the way they're used is that the bonds are sold to investors and the cash that is produced from those sales is then paid to the shareholders of the company that's being taken over. So, in other words, you wouldn't have to, if you wanted to take over a company and it was a $4 billion company, and if you were a small company, there's no way that a bank would loan you that kind of money. But since Milken could raise billions of dollars from the sale of junk bonds literally overnight, it meant that anyone, no matter how sort of small, could take over any other company, no matter how large.
Yeah, so you had very unusual things happening. Give us an example of a pretty small company that was able to take over a really large company because of financing from junk bonds.
Well, Nelson Peltz is one of my favorite examples. He had a controlling interest in a small company, Triangle Industries, which was a wire and cable company. Its revenues were something like $290 million. And it took over National Can, which had, just for so you frame of reference, had revenues of $1.9 billion. That's a good example of sort of the comparative sizes. And Nelson Peltz would never have been able to do that transaction if he didn't have Milken there to raise the financing.
So this junk bond financing was really knocking the whole balance of power out of whack.
Well, it certainly was challenging the established rules. I mean, what I say in the book is that it was as though the whole game was sort of turned upside down, because now the powerful, the strong and powerful, could be threatened by anyone. So in a sense, the weak became the strong and the strong became the weak. Or at least the strong became the threatened. Until Milken, the strong could only be threatened by someone basically of sort of equivalent size. And after Milken, this was no longer true.
When Milken was at his peak, and you say this was around in 1985, how was he regarded on Wall Street?
I would say actually his peak I would put in 1986, because 1985, Wall Street was still fighting him. There was the Revlon battle. Wall Street was still hoping to sort of stamp out this upstart. By 1986, he had really reached his peak, and he was not only really accepted by Wall Street, but he was imitated by it. There were articles in the business press comparing him to J.P. Morgan, and the rest of Wall Street, which had previously really despised Drexel and despised junk bonds, was now trying to get into the business.
Okay, let's get to the turnaround where things start to slide. You say, first of all, that junk bonds started to become junkier. You want to explain?
Well, as the enthusiasm for this kind of paper grew in the market, and there were buyers just everywhere for nearly any junk bond that could be issued, the quality of the bonds began to deteriorate, which means that the companies that would be issuing them would have less good credit. Basically, the point is that there was such enthusiasm, there was such belief that any deal would work, especially if it was Milken's deal, but such belief that any deal would work, that investors would buy pretty much anything.
And then, too, there were people who were pushing for protective legislation to prevent unfriendly takeovers.
There were people doing that, but basically none of those bills went anywhere. Drexel, not only because of this, but certainly part of it was that Drexel lobbied very effectively against that legislation.
One of the turning points in this story is the arrest of Ivan Boesky, his arrest for insider trading, for alleged insider trading at the time. Mm-hmm. Now, you and I guess the people on Wall Street call it Boesky Day. What's the date specifically of Boesky Day?
The date was, I guess it was November 14th, if I'm not wrong.
Of 86.
Of 86. And that was the day that Boesky, that his plea agreement with the government was announced, where he pled guilty to insider trading and was given the largest fine ever levied, which was $100 million.
What's his connection to the story that you're telling about junk bonds financing corporate takeovers?
Well, Boesky was an arbitrageur, and arbitrageurs are people who bet when a takeover is announced, they bet on the idea that the takeover is going to go through. They buy up the stock the day it's announced. If the stock is trading at $50 and if the takeover is going to go through at maybe $60, they buy it at $50 on the hopes that it's going to go through and they'll make $10 on each share. That's what an arbitrageur is. That's what Boesky is. And so he was a very important player in the whole takeover game because he accumulated enormous stock positions.
Okay, well, I want to get to more connections in the story, and we'll also talk about the effects of the stock market crash and the current investigation, the current SEC investigation into Drexel Burnham, the company that Michael Milken still works for. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is journalist Connie Brooks. She's the author of the new book, The Predator's Ball, which is about junk bonds and takeover mania. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist Connie Brook is my guest, author of The Predator's Ball, The Junk Bond Raiders, and The Man Who Staked Them. Well, Connie, we were just talking about Ivan Boesky and his connection to this story. Now, Drexel Burnham, the firm that Michael Milken has worked for years, is now under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission, and this is related to the Ivan Boesky affair. What's the connection?
Well, when Boesky pled guilty, part of his plea was that he would cooperate with the government. And he, we now know, has given the government loads of information which implicates Milken. It remains to be seen whether what Boesky has said is enough to cause Milken to be indicted, and more than that, enough to cause Milken to be convicted by a jury. But in any event, that is what Boesky did.
Do we know how he's implicated in the story?
How Milken is implicated? Mm-hmm. Well, there are basically, there are reports in the press. It's pretty complicated to say. I mean, basically, we know that Boesky has claimed that Milken has manipulated the markets in a variety of ways.
Okay. Let's look at the stock market crash of just a few months ago. Did that do anything to change the growth of junk bonds?
Well, for a while, for about a month or so, it seemed that it might have been. See, basically, the world is divided into two camps. There are the people who think that junk bonds are. I'm oversimplifying, but you can say this. The world is divided into two camps. There are the people who think that junk bonds are great, and there are the people who keep saying, well, yes, we know that nothing bad has happened so far, and we know that everybody is making money hand over foot. But as soon as there is a recession, you are going to see that the whole junk bond empire is going to come unraveled. Basically, these companies that have issued the junk bonds are going to go into default. And there will just be, it'll go like a house of cards. These are the two camps. Well, after the stock market crash, many people believed that a recession was about to come, and that if that recession came, exactly this, that all these companies would go into default and the junk bond empire would come undone. Junk bonds did plunge in price at the time, not plunge, but they went down sort of sharply in price after the stock market crash, but then they rebounded. So many people who were sort of writing the obituaries for the whole junk bond market had to eat their words because within several months, they basically came back as strong as ever.
So there's still a big market for junk bonds.
There still is a big, thriving market for junk bonds. Of course, the recession never came, obviously. So the people who say, well, come the recession, you will see junk bonds go, are still saying that, and they have not yet been proven wrong.
Are they still being used to finance corporate takeovers to the same extent that they were a couple of years ago.
Not, certainly not to the same extent. And Drexel is not as active in that market as they were then. But basically, Drexel is under this cloud. I mean, we can't, until the cloud of the government investigation is removed, Drexel will not be able to operate freely.
If there have been fewer of these unfriendly takeovers in the past couple of years, to what can we attribute that?
Well, I guess I would say that there were fewer in the... Well, that's not true.
Okay.
What there have been hostile takeovers, but they're more the way they used to be, which is of major companies by major companies.
As opposed to small companies buying bigger ones.
That's right, because as opposed to Drexel's kinds of clients, which were the have-nots of the corporate world, instead the transactions that have existed have been more enormous companies buying other enormous companies and financed, you know, with bank debt, not as much using junk bonds.
Connie, let's get back to something that you said at the very beginning of our interview. You said when you started off to report on this story, you really saw the main characters in this book, the people who were investing in the junk bonds, as being the underdogs.
Mm-hmm.
And you were pretty sympathetic
mm-hmm.
to it and wanted to see how the underdogs were challenging the big guys
mm-hmm.
on Wall Street. Now, you walked away with a very different impression than the one you started out with. How did it change?
Well, at the beginning, it didn't change, you know, 360 degrees. I basically thought at the beginning that Milken and his people were making so much money that it was possible that there had to be some sort of underside to this. And I guess what happened in the course of my reporting, which was about 2.5 years, is that I became convinced that there was a substantial underside, what looked to me like, you know, substantial illegality. And I just felt that it was a world that was dominated by one man, Milken, who was a genius, but who had no... I think that he's... My view of him is that he's someone who is a law unto himself and sort of feels he's beyond the law.
Now, you were able to interview Michael Milken for your book.
Mm-hmm.
How much time were you able to speak with him?
Well, I saw him twice in the whole course. I saw him at the beginning, and that was a brief meeting, and then I saw him at the very end, and that was for somewhere between 3 and 4 hours.
If the press reports are true about this, he offered to pay you for the amount of books you would have expected to sell had the book been published and sold, to tempt you to not finish writing the book.
Well, actually, the press reports are true, and what happened was that was the first meeting, which I mentioned, the brief meeting.
Well, explain to me what happened.
Milken was giving a speech to a group of security analysts in Boston, and one of them invited me to come. It wasn't open to the public, but he knew that I was just setting out then to write this book. It was February of 86. So he invited me to come, and after Milken's speech, I went up to him, and I told him who I was and what I was doing. And he said, "Oh, I've heard about your project. You know, I don't want it to be done." And I said, "Well, I'm doing it." And he said, "Well, why don't..." And that's when he said, "Why don't we pay you the money that your publisher would have paid you, except we'll pay it to you to not write the book."
What did you tell him?
I said, "That was fine, but what would I do for integrity for the rest of my life?"
And what did he say?
Well, actually, it was a two-part thing. He said, "Why don't we pay you the commitment fee that your publisher will pay you, except we'll pay it to you to not write the book?" And then I said, "Well, what will I do for integrity?" And then he said, "Or why don't we pay you for all the books that you would have sold if you had written it?" So I guess what he thought was that he just had not offered a big enough price the first time.
How did you decide whether or not to mention this to anyone and whether you should include it in your book or just tell it to the press?
Well, I just, at the time, I was sort of taken aback by it, but from what I was already hearing about Mike Milken, it didn't surprise me that much. So I sort of told it as a great anecdote to a couple of my friends, and I always thought that it would be part of my portrait of him in the book somewhere. I didn't know how it would come in, where it would be, but I always thought that it was certainly an interesting insight into the man. And then when I wrote the book, there was a place that seemed right for it. Basically, that leaked out. The way it got into the press was it leaked out before the book was published. I don't know who did that, but that's how it got into the press. So it wasn't that I went to the press with it.
Connie Brook is the author of The Predator's Ball, The Junk Bond Raiders, and The Man Who Staked Them. So you came away thinking that there was more underhanded stuff than you had initially expected to find in the story.
That's right. I did.
Can I ask you how, this is a big question, but how you think Wall Street has been changed by the story that you write about in your book, the story of the junk bonds and the financing of the unfriendly corporate takeovers?
Well, I think there really has been an immense restructuring, and that Milken, while he is not responsible for all of it, has done more to shape it than any other one individual. Because, I mean, first of all, there were the people that he backed who took over other companies, but more than that, he caused other companies who were fearful of being taken over to adapt some of the sort of methods themselves, to restructure themselves and to get leaner and trim down and cut costs. They did that for fear that they would be taken over if they were seen as too fat targets. And then there was the whole wave of leveraged buyouts, which he also has, he didn't originate that, but he contributed to it and made it much larger. Basically, the whole move to the owner-manager, as opposed to companies, you know, public companies being run by management, now they're very often, many cases, run by people who either have been taken private and so are owned totally, or are run by people who have a 20 or 30% stake in them. All these things, Michael Milken was not the sole originator of, but the person more than anyone else who is responsible for them.
Well, you had a few hours to talk with him. Did he strike you as a very charismatic man? Could you see in those few hours that you spent with him what it was about him that enabled him to start this new trend on Wall Street and attract a lot of clients and a lot of followers to his way of thinking?
I didn't really see it. He's very intense, and you can certainly see that. People refer to him as charismatic. I did not perceive him that way, but, you know, I was only with him for a few hours, and I do know that certainly the people who have worked for him, you know, see him as I say in my book, they see him as larger than life. Someone who used to be part of Milken's group said that, you know, if Milken had walked over a cliff, everyone in that group would have followed him. And someone else in his group said, you know, someone like Mike comes along once every 500 years. So although to me, although I didn't see it myself, I know that people are in awe of him.
Do you think that there's a moral to this story?
Well, I guess there's one thing that I was often thinking when I was writing. I thought of something Warren Buffett said, which is that he said you can get in much more trouble with a good idea than with a bad one. And I guess that's what I really think about Mike Milken. I think he had a you know, a great idea. And I think he got into a lot of trouble with it.
One last question. Are you an investor yourself?
No, never have. Don't own one stock.
And would this encourage you or discourage you from investing in the future? The research you've done.
I don't know. I never have thought of applying it to my own life.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your research. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
My guest has been journalist Connie Brook. Her new book about junk bonds and hostile corporate takeovers is titled The Predator's Ball. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Michael Harrington. He's the chairman of the Democratic Socialists of America and is one of this country's leading leftist authors. In his new autobiography, The Long Distance Runner, he tells of his long struggle in politics and of his current struggle with cancer. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides, publishers of Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Stuart Allen has as much trouble folding a road map as you and I do, and he's a map maker, but the maps he makes are so beautiful, many people buy them just to hang on the wall. Coming up, Stuart Allen tells us how he fits the world into two dimensions. Also in our weekly performance spot, fiddler Michael Doucette joins two members of his band Beau Soleil in a performance of A Cajun Waltz. And critic Ken Tucker reviews a new series of Japanese films now available on home video, and you can actually read the subtitles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. The British government today expelled an Israeli diplomat for activities incompatible with his diplomatic status, which usually means spying. NPR's Bill Buesenberg reports.
This is believed to be the first time any friendly Western government has publicly expelled an Israeli diplomat. It underscores the British government's anger with Israel for an intelligence operation on British territory, which appears to have condoned a murder. Here's what happened. Mossad, Israel's external intelligence agency, had a Palestinian double agent in England, who also had connections with the PLO. That agent, Ismail Sowan, was sentenced to 11 years in prison yesterday for possession of an illegal cache of arms and explosives. The weapons belonged to a high-level PLO member who the British believe was involved in last year's murder of an Arab cartoonist living in London. What the British government is so upset about is that Mossad, through its double agent, knew about the arms cache and probably knew about the murder, but never passed on any of that information to British officials. That violated agreements between the two countries' secret services. I'm Bill Buesenberg in London.
Israeli soldiers killed one Palestinian and wounded 18 in the occupied West Bank today. According to witnesses, army officials confirmed the death but claimed only four Arabs were wounded. They said two soldiers were also hurt. Israeli troops also demolished several houses today in the West Bank and sealed another 10. Most of the houses belonged to Palestinians suspected of throwing firebombs. Today, the Supreme Court severely limited the rights of towns to regulate the placement of coin-operated newspaper vending machines. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1983, the Cleveland suburb of Lakewood, Ohio, banned all newspaper racks on public property. When a federal court struck down that ordinance as unconstitutional, the city passed another ordinance requiring newspapers to get an annual license for news racks. The ordinance allowed the mayor to reject any newspaper's license by simply stating his reasons. The Cleveland Plain Dealer immediately challenged the city ordinance in court, claiming it violated the Constitution's guarantee to freedom of expression. Today, the Supreme Court agreed with the newspaper and struck down the Lakewood law. Writing for the court, Justice William Brennan said the ordinance contains no limits to the mayor's discretion and assumes that the mayor will act in good faith. But, said Brennan, when there is an absence of standards, as there was here, the possibility of censorship is at its zenith. The court specifically left unresolved the question of whether the city could have banned all news racks completely from the public streets. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Housing starts tumbled in May to their lowest level in more than 3 years. The Commerce Department reported today a 12.2% drop in new construction of single-family homes. Economist Dave Siders of the National Association of Home Builders says rising interest rates are to blame for most of the decline.
For a while, consumers were still coming into the market pretty strongly in anticipation of further increases, but I think by now that sort of short-term stimulative impact certainly has run its course, and I think we're seeing a more classic reaction now to the rate increases, which is a decline in housing demand.
The biggest drop came in multiple unit buildings. The market has been chronically weak because rental unit vacancy rates nationwide are at a 20-year high. Also, analysts point out that many tax benefits of investing in such buildings have been eliminated. Texaco today claimed victory over Carl Icahn at the conclusion of a crowded shareholder meeting where votes were cast in what was called the biggest board fight in corporate history. Icahn, Texaco's largest shareholder, has proposed that he and four associates be put on the board. And he's vowed to push for the sale of the company if he wins the seats. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's time for our weekly performance spot, and three members of the band Beau Soleil are back with some more Cajun dance music. We have Michael Doucette on fiddle and vocals, his brother David Doucette on guitar, and Jimmy Bro on accordion. They're going to play a waltz about a love that doesn't quite work out. Michael says it was written by one of the all-time great Cajun fiddlers.
Now we'd like to do a song by Dennis McGee, who had this, who came about this song in a dream, and we kind of put a sort of a different beat to it. It's a waltz, but it's a beautiful waltz. It's called Pauline, and it's about you know, the whole sort of Romeo and Juliet love match where they put Pauline in a convent, and the other guy goes off to war, and he comes back, and she dies. What a love song.
Pour ma chère Pauline.
Michael Doucette, David Doucette, and Jimmy Bro. Beausoleil's latest album, Bayou Boogie, is on the Rounder record label. This is Fresh Air. From his office overlooking downtown Medford, Oregon, Stuart Allen wants to change the way we see the world. Allen is a cartographer, or mapmaker. Part of the time, he designs conventional maps for oil companies or the government. But the rest of his time, he constructs oversized state wall maps, maps he hopes people will find beautiful and geographically inspiring. For most of us, our only contact with maps is when we need to get from here to there. I asked Stuart Allen what he thought of ordinary road maps.
You could say that they're not designed. They're constructed with a pretty simple end in mind, which is just that you're going to show people how to get to their great aunt's house, even if they've never been there before, on the other side of the state. They work for that. What they don't do is give you any sense of what that terrain is. That's where that range of mountains is. That's where that valley that I particularly like is, and that's the way it relates to, other cities or whatever.
I like what you're saying there about, so that's where it is, so that's where I am. Not too long ago, I had to make a trip, and I didn't have time to consult a map before flying to where I was going, and I had no idea where I was. I knew I was in the Midwest somewhere, but without a map, I really felt lost, just totally displaced.
In fact, I was flying over the Midwest last week, and I had a state road map in my lap, and I was very pleased with myself. As I never think of that, or if I do think of it, it's in the baggage. But this was carry on, so I was following the Illinois River as we were approaching O'Hare, and seeing towns that I knew on the ground, towns that I'd been in 25 years before and hadn't been in since. Felt very smug because I had the information there, and that's what a map ought to do, is give you the knowledge of where you are, give you the setting, it places you. It's, what is this that I'm going through? What's the setting? Where am I? Not in the sense of where am I in between two points, but what is this whole setting? What's beyond the horizon? Where did this river come from that I'm crossing, and where does it go?
Well, you're interested in making your maps beautiful. How have you alter the design within the map to make it more pleasing? One of the things I can think of is that you use gorgeous colors. I mean, you have You have beautiful shades of blue-green that vary in intensity depending on the elevation. You have, really beautiful earth colors, different shades of browns in it.
One thing we do is use a lot of inks, which makes it a more expensive printing and a more expensive construction process. Really the key is that we set out to make beautiful maps, and that's pretty much not done anymore. It was done, of course, in the old days, with the whales and the galleons and the goddesses and whatnot that were added to the maps. But as maps really became part of the military infrastructure, what became critical was that everything be precisely accurate. Well, everything should be precisely accurate, and is on our maps. But at some point there, the idea that the map should be beautiful in itself, a beautiful object, tended to fall away. And in fact, that was regarded as a distraction or a nuisance. It doesn't have to be, and it shouldn't be. I mean, ideally, a map is maybe the one place where truth and beauty are combined, or should be combined. I mean, there's no conflict. There's no fight between them.
Well, let's talk about the truth for a minute. You've talked a little bit about the beauty. How do you get the information that you need for your maps? Are you basically, for the main part of it, recopying maps that already exist?
Oh, yeah. Cartographers are great thieves. maps basically are stolen from existing maps.
And is that considered legitimate?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's considered legitimate, particularly since you're normally stealing from your own government and from other and from other governments. Most of the information is public domain, and in fact, the state map series mostly consists of materials which are available from the U.S. Geological Survey. We handle them differently. We do different things with them, and that's what makes our maps look so different.
Now, you're also a traditional cartographer, right?
We do contract cartographic work for all kinds of people, particularly oil companies or scientific organizations or government agencies. Yeah, doing more conventional stuff. And that's interesting, and that's basically the work that pays the rent. But what we've wanted to do is kind of expand the boundaries of cartography as, sort of consumer art, if that's a category that exists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If we looked at your state map of California and compared that to a state map of California that was drawn, say, 50 or maybe 100 years ago, would the geography of California be represented differently? I don't mean that, the colors or the sensibility or anything, but just would the shape of the state have been any different? Has the knowledge that cartographers have now changed over the last century or half a century?
Yeah, the shape of the state it might be imperceptibly different, but you would have to measure it very precisely to tell. Certainly the surveys have become much more accurate. Now, between the satellite digital imagery and all the navigation aids, and the digital, the capacity to record information about absolutely everything digitally and retrieve it and stick it on a display some way, now we really know where everything is in the world, really in the world. Even places that were never mapped because they were under perpetual cloud cover are now mapped with radar. So in the last 10 years, we really know what the Amazon basin all looks like, which was never possible before. We know what everything looks like, and we're all of the major powers spying on each other and the rest of the world all the time, and mapping each other and the rest of the world all the time for military purposes. Most of the stuff never becomes available to the public. An awful lot of it goes into microchips on the nose of a bomber or into the nose of a missile, which is a disquieting thought. The warhead has a fantastic cartographic memory.
Did you fall in love with maps when you were a kid?
Yeah, I did. A lot of people love maps, and I did as a kid, although I never expected to go into it. I kind of backed into it, as so many of us back into our careers.
See, my early childhood memories of maps was having a teacher with this huge map that she would unroll from the blackboard. There'd be a pointer, and she'd choose you, have you, come up, and point to some obscure country that you'd never even heard of, and you knew you'd never be able to find it on the map. So maps were always kind of tied in with a certain amount of humiliation to me when I was young.
Yeah, the abuse of geography. Well, that probably doesn't happen anymore, because I don't think it occurs to anyone that a kid would know where anything is anymore. You know, really, I think that's about right. They don't teach it. You've probably seen national surveys reported in the press. Kids, you know, don't know where Vietnam is. In fact, they're not sure that there is such a place, or maybe it's a rock group or something like that. Yeah, there is that unfortunate kind of, you know, storing up the lore. How many points on this enormous map can you properly identify, which is a shame. Really, if the map is beautiful enough, it sinks into your consciousness, you're going to absorb it, you know, to a great extent anyway.
So what map are you working on now?
Well, that's a series of maps of the world. There are going to be, I think, six of them. And then we just finished a map of Hawaii, including the seafloor, which looks very three-dimensional. That's been very satisfying. It just was printed 2 weeks ago, and we see people come up and feel it and kind of jump, because they think it's a plastic raised relief map. You know? And then their fingers tell them it's flat, that their eye, their brain is telling them that it's three-dimensional. And there's a kind of a startled jump that people give when they see that. And when I see that, I think, you know, that one worked. You know, that one is doing what it's supposed to do.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Cartographer Stuart Allen is a partner in the company Raven Maps in Medford, Oregon. He spoke to us from NPR station KSOR in nearby Ashland. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
Oh, we have, among other things, an interesting story, but a little spy story in Britain in which the British have expelled an Israeli journalist, in part for the espionage they were conducting over the PLO.
We've got a big weekend coming up, an economic summit in Toronto, and Father's Day. What are you doing?
That's right. A lot of us will be getting ties to mark the economic summit this weekend. We will be hearing about the summit, about a new Japanese proposal for improving North-South economic relations, and what two Washington experts on development make of the French proposal to forgive some African debt. Also, Jim Metzner for Father's Day, a sound remembrance of a favorite grandfather.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new series of home videos featuring Japanese films from the post-war era, including whodunits and suburban comedies. Critic Ken Tucker has a review.
If you're anything like me, one reason you don't watch very many foreign films on videocassette is that the subtitles are teeny tiny, headache-inducing. If you're also anything like me, you don't even consider dubbed foreign films a possible alternative. If I want to hear someone speaking in a voice that isn't her own, I'll watch The Exorcist. This may sound hopelessly middlebrow. I guess I should risk a migraine to spend time in the presence of art, but it's the honest bottom line on why I watch the foreign films I do see in movie theaters. But a new series of video releases is so good I've abandoned my principles and sit enthralled, gulping an occasional aspirin. Sony Video has teamed up with the Japan Society to release a series of classic Japanese movies. The first four films in the series range from Akira Kurosawa's gritty 1949 thriller Stray Dog to Yasuhiro Ozu's 1951 comedy of manners, Early Summer. It's often been remarked that Kurosawa is the most Western of all Japanese filmmakers, and like many of his movies, Stray Dog uses a genre very familiar to Americans, the detective film, to create a tense little drama. By contrast, the director Ozu is frequently cited as a quintessentially Japanese director, one whose movies are intent on examining Japanese society and family relationships. Early Summer, however, has much to say to a Western audience about the role of women in any society. It tells the story of Noriko, a 28-year-old secretary who works for her businessman brother and still lives at home with her parents and elderly granduncle. Noriko is an intelligent, good-natured, not particularly aggressive woman, but she resists when her relatives try to pressure her into marrying a friend of her brother's, a 40-year-old businessman who is perfectly nice. Her brother describes him as, quote, a good golfer and handsome. But he's not someone for whom Noriko feels any love. In this excerpt, Noriko is eating dinner with her brother and his wife. She announces that while she can get married, she doesn't want to, a concept her brother finds entirely too emancipated. I'm sorry I couldn't provide subtitles for the non-Japanese speaking among you, but it's a measure of the skills of these actors that much of the low-key drama and high emotion in that scene is conveyed in their voices. The subtitles are, for the most part, bright and clear and easy to read, well worth the effort given the quality of these films. Other new video cassette releases include Throw Mama from the Train, an enthusiastically mean-spirited comedy starring Danny DeVito and Billy Crystal. There's also Barfly, director Barbette Schroeder's film adaptation of a Charles Bukowski screenplay. Mickey Rourke plays a highly romanticized version of Bukowski himself, a hard-drinking poet who falls in love with a gorgeous drunk played by Faye Dunaway. Mickey Rourke looks like he hasn't bathed in a month, and he mutters hostile imprecations out of the side of his mouth like Popeye did in the old Max Fleischer cartoons. Barfly is so outrageously unbelievable, so willing to laugh at itself while offering some terrific acting, that it's a very entertaining goof.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with dance critic Deborah Jowett. In her new book, Time and the Dancing Image, Jowett analyzes the different ways in which dance has idealized male and female bodies. And we'll have reviews of jazz violinist Billy Bang's new album and a pilot for a new TV series called Try to Remember. It presents a visual time capsule of the events of one week in history. The first episode looks at the week of August 10th, 1969. That was the week of Hurricane Camille, Woodstock, and a ticker tape parade for Apollo astronauts. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Dan Cornwell, Barton Foyes, and Deirdre Benzing. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We had our troubles.